what, you know, what, you hear so many conflicting stories about her.
Well, I don't want to put him on the spot at all, but General Doolittle, did you ever meet Amelia Earhart in your...
Yes, I knew Amelia Earhart. We traveled in different groups, so we did not spend a great deal of time together.
Do you remember any specific instance, any specific time, place that you met her?
No. They were all casual, nothing of, really nothing of interest.
What was the prevailing opinion of women in aviation at that time? I think I know the answer, but and what was your opinion of women pilots at that time?
I had no strong convictions. I knew quite a few of them, and the women made excellent pilots. They did a particularly good job when they ferried aircraft across the Atlantic during World War II. And that let men to be in the on the battle line while they were bringing the tools to them. I think Amelia was an excellent pilot. She there were a group of pilots. Another well-known one was Pancho Barnes at that time, all of whom flew very well.
Did you ever have any opinion or idea of what you thought might have happened to her when she was flying around?
I have no input or no insight.
No insight into it. Okay. Do you remember where you were at the time, or do you remember hearing about it?
Well, I remember, but I don't remember what I was doing or where I was at the time.
I've never seen...
In those days, aviation people were highly mobile. They were apt to be in New York today and Los Angeles tomorrow.
Did you ever meet her husband? George Palmer Putnam?
I knew him slightly.
Okay.
But our, there also we were, we did not know one another very well.
Okay.
The aviation fraternity was small. I think almost everybody knew everybody else. And on the other hand, you had your particular pals, your particular buddies, your close little set mm-hmm. that you worked with.
Now, she was friends with Terry and her husband, wasn't she?
So that, yes, through the years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you those questions. I tell you something I would particularly like to interview about, and in fact I would like to write an article for the Airline Pilot magazine. As you know, we have been striving the last 8 or 10 years and still working on going to what we call Category 3C or complete 00 landings. We haven't made it yet. We have got down to Category 3A, and we're landing now with as little as 700 to 600 feet of forward visibility. But the complete 00 we haven't been able to accomplish. And yet you accomplished that many years ago in an NY-2, if I remember correctly. And that was in September, was that 1929 or 30, or do you remember?
Probably 29.
I can look that up easily enough. I've read accounts of that. And by the way, Mr. Glines, who you've worked with, is also, we've worked with him too, and he's a personal friend of ours. Mr. Glines wrote about it in his biography that he did for the Air Force series, and I've read other articles about it. And I've read, and I'm going to go to New York and around and read the newspapers of the times, but newspapers are notoriously bad in they want to report something that the reader wants to hear rather than what the facts may be.
Let me give you a little insight on that. There was a chap named Harry Guggenheim. He was a Navy pilot, in World War I and World War II. He was very interested in aviation. He established a blind flight laboratory in which I was in charge. Our job was to take off, to be able to develop the instrumentation and techniques necessary to be able to take off and land in zero weather, that is, without seeing outside the airplane. Under our aegis, the artificial horizon, the directional gyroscope were conceived. Sensitive altimeter. I took him up on his first trip in an airplane with the altimeter in his lap, and that gave us about a tenfold increase in tenfold better
height above the ground.
Height above the ground. And that flight was made in, I'm quite sure, in 1929. And that did indicate that we had the instrumentation necessary and the skill necessary to fly almost regardless of weather conditions. The worst thing you could run into probably would be a sleet storm.
Still is a bad deal. But now our problem isn't flying through it. Our problem is stopping once we get on the ground. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yes, sir.
This is a little sidelight. I thought it was interesting. The Guggenheims put up $2.5 million, if I remember correctly, which was a lot of money. Still is a lot of money, but it was a lot of money in those days. And yet hardly anyone remembers the Guggenheim Foundation for that. I think probably 3 out of 4 people, if you ask them on the street who was Guggenheim, they say, oh, he was an artist that lived a while back, because of the Guggenheim Museum being such a well-known worldwide attraction. I wanted to ask you about several questions, and if I can kind of get you back to that day in September, around 1929. I'll look up the exact dates.
It is 29.
That's no problem. You're correct. It is 29, she said. You did it early in the morning, probably because the air was pretty still and there wasn't much wind.
I had my mechanic on the job of checking in every morning till we had a condition of zero fog. This morning he awakened me, said it's before daylight, and I got out there and got in the airplane and flew it around in real zero fog.
It was real?
Yes, and then we called Harry Guggenheim, and Harry, I was going to do it again under the hood. And this time, he made me carry a man in the front seat. I did it all under the hood, but there was an observer. What wasn't zero weather, but what was zero visibility because I was under a hood.
I understand. Now, the first time you did it, there was no safety pilot.
No.
And so if you'd have made a mistake, you'd have paid the price.
That's right. But there was a real 0-0 fog, one of the few I've ever seen.
Okay, now.
Which lifted as the day went on.
And by the time Guggenheim got there, and so you could demonstrate this under the hood, that you would do it under the hood,
pilot.
And then he made you put a safety pilot on for it. But you did it without the safety pilot touching anything or saying anything.
That's
again.
Right.
Okay, now, I'm interested in the procedure. As I remember, you took off, you flew out for 15 minutes, or something, and made a turn. Do you remember the procedure you used?
There was a radio beacon, which was part of the part of the government.
Okay. A radio range station with 4 legs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that was my point. It was only a short distance from Mitchell Field on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point that everything emanated from.
Okay, but that the cone of silence?
I flew over it, flew a certain distance beyond it, did a quick turn, came down, lowered away, and then at the edge of Mitchell Field, I had a fan beacon, like this.
Uh-huh.
So no matter where I hit it, it told me I was over the field. and then just flew into the ground very, very slowly.
And so you stayed, as you went out, did you stay on the range leg? Did you keep a steady tone? If you got an A, you'd turn this way. If you got an N?
Well, I think it became second nature with me. That thing, I knew where that thing was, and I could do almost anything I wanted around that thing because I knew where it was. And I knew where the beams were coming out.
And so you, did you make a procedure turn? Did you fly out for 45 seconds and then do a 180 and come back? You did a regular procedure turn?
I had done this time after time when I could see what I was doing. So it was merely doing blind with the aid of the instrumentation of the airplane and the equipment on the ground. Just went out and made a procedure turn, carried and landed. Really very simple.
When you did the procedure turn, did you turn off 45 degrees, fly for 1 minute, then do a 180 and fly back to the lake, or did you do what we call a California turnaround?
I just did I pulled off a little bit. Here was the beacon.
Okay.
I pulled off a little this way, went around like that, came back, hit the beacon again, flew right in. This was the airfield here.
I see. And you went right over the cone then.
And then there was a, here I had
Bandmarker.
Bandmarker.
Okay. And so...
And there was nothing in between.
That was all water out there.
No, it was land. It was at Mitchell Field. It was all land, but it just happened that there was a nice flat stretch with nothing high.
You know, we do an approach that comes almost right over Mitchell Field, the same way. We call it a Canarsie approach now. And we actually do it in jets, and we come in over the Canarsie VOR, and then we have lead-in lights, and we follow those lead-in lights right over Mitchell Field to the new runways at Kennedy. And I'd like to tie this in to the people who are flying into Kennedy. Next time you do a Canarsie approach, you can thank General Doolittle for back that September day of 29, and then I'd like to relate just how you did it. Now, I can get the old range station and set the whole thing up. So you took off, and did you fly to the west or to the south or east? I am sorry.
To the east.
It was to the east. Could that be flat land and water out
coming,
of that?
Coming in, you landing to the west.
To the west.
Remaining westerlies.
So you would come over the cone then, and I believe you'd be about 200 feet at that point.
Be lower.
You'd be lower than that.
Probably 50 feet.
50 feet, just so you miss the towers of the range station. And depending upon your altimeter to keep you from running into anything.
That's right.
And then...
Now, remember at that time, Colesman came out with a sensitive altimeter, which was about 10 times as sensitive. That is, I could tell when I was, say, 10 feet from the ground, I knew that I wasn't on the ground, I knew I wasn't 20 feet. So within a few feet, it was about 10 times as accurate as the ordinary altimeter, and that was a great help. Colesman was a Swiss watchmaker, and he utilized his talents as a watchmaker in the sensitive altimeter, and came to me to tell me about it. I was extremely interested. I took him up on his first flight in an airplane, and during which he had the altimeter in his lap.
And Colesman actually flew with you.
He flew with his altimeter.
Just holding it in his hand.
Holding his hands.
And I think you worked with Sperry also on that same.
Elmer Sperry Sr. was a very good friend of mine. Elmer Sperry Jr. was about my age, and we were very close. He got so interested in this thing that he turned Elmer Sperry Jr. over to me, and I had him all during the whole period, and he was a godsend. He and his wife, Helen, were dear friends, and they spent much more time at our house than they did at their own during that almost a year that we were developing the instrumentation, the techniques, and carrying out the mission.
And through their efforts...
Now, wait a minute. That's Elmer Sperry Jr.
Yeah.
Elmer Sperry Sr. was the Elmer Sperry that had...
But he gave his son counsel and advice in the background and let his son work full-time with you.
That's right.
You know, there's another there's another point to this thing that's kind of interesting in that as soon as you succeeded, you worked yourself out of a job.
That's right. I had an opportunity to go work for the Shell Oil Company, so I left the service, went to work for the Shell Oil Company for a month. The deal was, if I liked it, I'd stay on. If they liked me, they'd keep me on. We both liked each other, or it was fixed. So then I left the service and did not get back in. Went into the reserves, did not get back on active duty until just before World War II.
So your association with Shell Oil Company then was all the way from 1926, 7,
no,
about 4?
I didn't go with them until, I think, 1930.
Right after this, you went to work for Shell Oil. So 1930, then, for over 50 years.
Yep.
So you got me beat with a flying tiger line. I'm a kid with only 40 years.
Excuse me just a second.
Paper reports. I want to work out this approach in there. So you would get right down to you knew what altitude you could fly at safely.
Yes.
And you could hold that altitude at 5 or 10 feet.
I held the altitude that was above all things, that was windmills, telephone poles, tall trees. And all of the things that were around there, I had a mental picture of that whole area. And so I merely kept above all of those things until I came over a certain beacon, which told me that the airfield was straight ahead and a certain distance ahead. Then I knew I could start letting down right down at the ground.
Okay, so your procedure turn and everything would be a little higher altitude.
That's right.
Then when you pass the low cone coming in, then you would follow the range leg to the west to the field.
That's right.
And then you would let down about 50 feet because you knew there was nothing between the range station and the field. And then when you hit the marker, you knew that you were at the boundary of the field. You had it all set up at the right airspeed and the right altitude. Yeah. You just chopped the power and held the attitude until you touched. Yeah. Hoping it came out all right. But you'd practice that. You'd practice that visually and whatnot. How many times do you estimate?
I don't know, but it was second nature.
You'd done it literally hundreds of times.
Yeah.
But never without peeking or at all. You were just practicing the procedures and looking at this and watching the instruments, looking outside, and getting it all to work together. So after a while, you found yourself looking outside less and less.
That's right.
And pretty soon, even before you ever looked outside, you knew exactly what you were going to see.
That's right. If I had looked outside.
If you had made a mistake. But wind would have affected you. But, of course, you wouldn't have fog if you had wind.
No. In the fairly early morning, when most of this work was done, the winds were ordinarily low. In any case, the prevailing winds were from the west, which was right along the axis of my plan.
So you'd be landing into the wind, prevailing early morning winds anyway. Yeah. How about, did you worry about birds at all?
No, because I have run into birds from time to time, and they're not much of a hazard, particularly in a slow-moving airplane.
When your mechanic called you, were you at home?
I lived at the field.
You lived at the field?
Yeah.
Did you walk to the hangar?
It was only a couple hundred yards.
Was it nice and foggy?
You could hardly see your hand in front of your face.
So, did you ever consider to yourself that maybe my biggest problem was to find the hangar rather than...
Well, I knew the ground.
Okay, but it was very, very foggy.
It was really a 0-0 fog.
It was what you were looking for.
Yeah.
How about carburetor heat? Were you worried about icing with that fog?
No.
NY2 engine, I don't know what kind of engine it had, I'll look that up, but it wasn't prone to icing. The early morning hours with fog in September, even though the temperature was probably 55 or 60 degrees, that's still a perfect time for carburetor ice. So.
I had no carburetor icing problem whatsoever. Okay.
Do you remember if you even had carburetor heat in those days?
I could probably
look it up anyway. When you had done it so many times, but never when it was really 00, your adrenaline must have been up, your pulse rate must have been up, probably your breathing, or were you so confident in what you were doing that it was just el automatico? So you felt so confident and secure in your abilities and your procedures that you really, the fog was not a hindrance. Thank God it's finally good and foggy so I can do this one.
It was a blessed fog.
Blessed. Okay. Did you have any sort of special... any sort of special touchdown area or warning if you were past the field? Or once you passed that fan marker?
I never passed the fan marker other than just a very low altitude.
So there's no way at that altitude with the power off that you could get to the other end of the field. Somewhere in between, you were going to hit ground. Hopefully the airport. Okay, was there any lights on at the time? You remember? Nothing. They probably didn't even have anything but boundary lights, if that, in those days. Did they have floodlights, do you remember?
Yeah, I don't believe so.
There wasn't a night field at all.
I don't believe so.
When you landed at night, in those days, it was either, I don't think there was any lighted fields hardly in those days, were there?
There were relatively few.
Somebody would just take a couple automobiles out and point their headlights or something?
Down on the Mexican border, that's exactly what we did. Was when we were coming in after dark, where you got an automobile, used the headlights, put him right on the edge of the field, the headlights, and then it right over him. And
you're supposed to touch down right in the headlight pattern.
Headlights on your tail.
Just so you'd miss him when you touched down. Okay. Well, I don't want to tire you. I know you didn't like Border Patrol work. In fact, that was one of the reasons you decided to get out of the service, I think, if I have heard that.
No, I enjoyed the flying, but I had left the Border Patrol and had flown, for instance, out of Dayton and out of New York for quite a few years, so it wasn't immediately after I left.
Did you fly the airmail at all?
No, I never flew the airmail. Who qualified? I was making a transcontinental flight, record flight, and I took along a package of mail in order to deliver the mail. But that was purely a trick, not a normal airmail operation.
Did you know Dick Merrill?
Very well.
We became quite acquainted with Dick after he retired from Eastern, and when he was working up there in Virginia.
Fredericksburg.
He's a fine pilot and a fine gentleman.
And see that.
I'll probably see you tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you much.
Right.
Well, unless you can think of something, I would like to relate, with your permission, a story built around what you have said and what other things I can get from newspapers of the time and other books and whatnot. But I would try and write it from a pilot's point of view. The first Category 3C landing ever made. And I would like to write it strictly for professional airline pilots. giving you the credit, and when they bring their load of passengers in safely.
If you want me to take a peek at it, I'll be glad to do so.
All right, thank you.
Make sure there are
no errors, no flagrant
mistakes in what I meant to say and what I said.
Okay, I will follow up with that, and I'll try and reproduce the actual. I'll draw a diagram of how you flew it and whatnot, and I'll probably have to get in touch with you again sometime and run over that.
Sure, that's very quickly. This was before the days of runways.
Yes, everything, and a field was a field. Okay, you want me to go in?
Yeah.
Do you want me to follow you here? Oh, you're going to drop. Oh, beautiful. You're going to have to sign this drawing, too.
Also, maybe our books.
Yeah, we'll get that.
C.V. Glynn gave us some books about you.
I'm going to get over here and sit somewhere. Why don't you take a picture of him while he's drawing that? Possibly get me in it, too. Mitchell Field, okay? And marker. Was that a 75 mega cycle band marker as we know him, or was that something earlier? You don't really remember. Did you get a light, or was it a tone?
I had a hand. I was to the right, the hand was there. If I was to the left, the hand was there. So I had to keep the hand in the middle.
Okay.
That was the expectation. Now this is, here's Mitchell Field. Nora.
That's Nora, uh-huh.
The hangars were along here. Fan beacon was here, regular beacon here, so I would just fly along getting this beacon so that I knew I was coming just about over it.
Now you did that with an A and an N?
Yeah.
A da-da or a da-did or a steady tone?
A-N-N. Mm-hmm. Came around here to this beacon, passed over the beacon, went around like that, lined up on the beacon again.
Hit the cone. Let down to your final altitude, hit the fan marker, pull the power.
Right.
Do you remember what altitudes? In the book, he said you flew at about 200 feet out here. Is that the.
Out here, at about 600.
About 600 feet.
Yeah.
Okay.
But by the time I got into here, it was about 200.
About 200.
And then letting away to the.
Fan marker, you'd be about 50 feet, you think?
Not more. Not more than 50.
Not more than 50 feet. Can I get you to sign that?
This is really a thrill for Elgin to be able to discuss this.
I'm going to have fun writing
his whole career. He's talked to me about how you started blind flying and what it has done for him as a pilot.
You can't hardly find anyone anymore that ever flew a range slate. They wouldn't know what a low cone or a high cone or cone of silence was anymore. We have only a few fan markers on the instrument approaches now. Other than that, we don't even have them on airways hardly. Okay, I'll save that.
Elgin, would you give him your pen? I'd like you to sign. We got these from C.V. Glynn. C.V. has been talking to me about writing a book about Elgin.
Mm-hmm.
And I consider him a good writer. So he wrote and sent us these books. And we've been reading them and studying your history.
You want me to sign that?
I want you to sign it,
I would like
too.
To have you sign it.
How long have you been printing? How long have you been printing?
I studied first mining engineering and then aeronautical engineering. When you were an engineer, you print.
Elgin always prints is why he was asking you.
I always print. I don't. It comes from being a radio operator, I think.
And see, today is what?
8:27.
8:25.
5. Yeah.
86.
I don't even know what day it is.
No, how can you? The way you fly around this world.
I could like to bother you one more time if I might.
Yeah.
This is a narrator.
These books will eventually go into the museum, just for your information. He's got a little phrase, every good wish. Elgin's little phrase is, make your dreams come true. And it's 8/25/86. We really appreciate this. And they will
no problem.
Be, and they really will be in the museum when we finish with all of our research.
You'll enjoy this.
Okay, thank you.
And we think your son will, too. Elgin, anything else you wanted to ask him while we're here?
No, I will come. When I try and write it, I will have to probably call you or Donna and ask a specific question.
Okay.
And then when I get it written and drawn up, I'll make a draft and present it to you.
Good. His pen.
Pardon?
Is your pen his?
No, it's his.
Okay.
I didn't
you
steal
get your pen back?
I just want to make sure he didn't steal yours.
Yeah, they're almost the same.
Thanks.
So I didn't steal it. Can I take a picture with you, Marie?
Sure.
You want a picture taken with a pretty girl?
You know, I have...
That would pleasure me.
I want to tell you some things that you will relate to. First of all, his great-grandparents came over the Oregon Trail and went to Sutter's Creek and gold mining. So I think that's how he became a pioneer of his own right, see. And then he met me in L.A., just like you met your wife, only not at school. He was 17. He had lied to get into the Navy. And when he got out, we got married in L.A. So we have a lot in common in that respect, because I understand you and your wife met in L.A.
That's right.
And,
she was a Southern girl, spoke with a very distinct Southern accent, but you'd be surprised how quickly kids will get over something like that because other kids heckle them.
Yes, other kids don't like to. Well, my family was from Yugoslavia, so until I went to school, I knew nothing but Slavic language. So I know, because I got called a Dago, even though I wasn't. But I thought it was interesting. We were married when he was 18, and we're married 40 years now. So we got married when he was very young, too. And sometimes I think it takes that tough woman to be there through all this. And somebody you know you can count on, right?
We have something else in common. I was raised on the Oregon coast, where the temperature wasn't as cold as Nome in the winter, but it rained, and it was foggy and cold, and I lived in a tent when I was first raised. Well, I come from a poor family, and my mother, in a crib, lucky that I had a basket or something, she'd take the umbrella and put it over me, because the tent leaked so bad to protect the poor baby, because I couldn't get out of there. She'd put the umbrella over me so I wouldn't get soaking wet.
So, and that's where we read that you lived in tents and things in Nome with your parents?
Well, no. My dad went into Alaska in 97. I was born in 96. He went in 97. My mother and I joined him in 1900 in Nome. That was the year of the big gold rush at Nome. And he had been there. Well, he had been about a year at Nome before we got there. He went up to the Klondike before that. And so everything was all set for us when my mother and I arrived in Nome. We just moved right into a little house.
He built a house before you came. I see. So anyway, you as pioneers, I kind of feel that Elgin's background contributed to his wanting to do his own pioneering.
I think so.
It's something you heard about. You experienced
something here.
Something inside, and there's something you can't deny. And like he said, when he was doing his trip around the world, it wasn't for money. It wasn't for fame. It wasn't for any of those things, because we did not capitalize on any of that. What it was for was to give back to the community of aviation what he had felt he had received, and that's it.
Quid pro quo.
That's right. And if we don't do that with our lives, I feel that, you know, why are we here? You
know. Couldn't agree with you more.
And so consequently, we work out real well together because we both have that feeling. And our children understand it. And
how many children?
Two. Our son is 36 in September, and our daughter is 38. And we have three grandchildren. So we're pretty busy with family as much as we can spend. And then my involvement with the museum simply came out of a desire. All of the history of the Bay Area great events was disappearing. You know, all of the different books and things are all gone either to Washington or some other area. So I felt it imperative to work with these people that are really sincerely interested in preserving our history in the area, because it's just going to be gone if we don't. And how are we going to teach our young people something besides what they see on television, which is 9 times out of 10 somebody shooting somebody? I want them to be able to experience the greatness of the people that have lived in the past and be able to learn from that and be able to say, hey, look, I can do that. I mean, there's nothing that stops me from doing something too. And that's basically how I got involved with what we're doing now, which is in the museum. And we're going to bring up Amelia Earhart's airplane, and we're going to hang it in there.
Is the old NY-2 gone? All of those gone? Did anybody ever save them, like the NY-2 that you made the first flight in, first line flight?
I think. I'm not sure.
Did you know Eddie Gorski?
My name rings a bell, but
he was a mechanic out of Teterboro, Asbrook Heights. Eddie Gorski. He's still alive. He's probably older than you are.
Yeah, I'll be 90 in December.
That's wonderful. Did your family come to Sutter's Fort?
No, I think that what I...
My mother was a Californian.
Oh, she was a Californian.
My dad was a Bostonian, and he came around the Cape Horn.
To San Francisco.
To San Francisco. And they met there and had a home in Alameda. That's where I came into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad, carpenter by trade, wanderlust.
By nature, huh?
By nature.
went up to first the Yukon, then to Nome. And I can remember some things in Nome. Two things that I remember distinctly. I must have been about 5. I was walking along the beach, skipping stones in the water. And a seagull came down low and a stone hit him in the head. I remember walking out to my knees, having the seagull under my arm, patting his head, and the seagull came to
you and bit you.
Put my finger right into the hole. I dropped him quickly. The other thing I remember was also walking along the beach. I was walking along the beach and a little Eskimo boy came by. Now, I do not know what caused the altercation, but I punched him in his little flat nose, and blood spurted in all directions. Neither he nor I had ever seen a nosebleed before. He ran home to his mother, telling her he was bleeding to death. I ran home to my mother, saying, I just killed me an Eskimo.
You know, it's strange, because Eskimos are not not known to be aggressive.
Oh, they weren't. They were very, very calm, cool, collected.
Something got through it. You also sold newspapers, I understand.
Yes, there was a little local newspaper called the Nome Nugget.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as soon as navigation opened and newspapers began to come in from the outside, where the newspaper boys were
out of business.
How old were you when you sold newspapers?
We sold these
I was about 6 or 7 when I started selling newspapers. I used to sell the News Telegram out of Portland, Oregon. Come in on the stage.
Some folks had them sent right directly to them. But most of them bought either from the newspaper boy or bought somebody else's paper.
As a newspaper boy, I used to go around all the dining rooms and restaurants and bars and pull on their pant legs, want to buy a paper, you know, and I'd get that waif look in my eyes. Oh, you know
what? Real sad. I'm hungry.
I might even tear my pants a little bit.
He knows
all the tricks, too.
He knows the tricks, too. Did your mother have family in Los Angeles? That's how you happened to go there, to end there?
No, in San Francisco.
Oh, in San Francisco.
My mother lived in Northern California, and we went to Los Angeles, yes, but we also spent some time in Texas.
What did your mother do when you were living in Los Angeles? Did she work somewhere?
My dad, of course, sent out money to take care of both of us. Yes, I remember one of her things was a hat store. She had one room of our house. That's where she made hats and sold them. She was very, very ingenious. I remember she and I used to go out with a dog team and a sled and 6 5-gallon cans and the sled to a nearby creek, which was flowed pretty fast, and it was easy to get a hold to it and get water.
That was in Nome.
Yes.
You went to Manual Arts High School.
Yes.
Do you remember where you lived? Remember what address you lived in Los Angeles in those days?
Part of that time we lived in, between 12th and Pico on, I believe, St. Andrews.
Well, see, we lived just west of there.
Yep. We lived right by L.A. High School.
My brother went to Los Angeles High School, and I lived on Keniston and Olympic, between Pico and Olympic.
Well, when Manual Arts High School was built, it was right on the edge of the city. Now, of course, it's
in the middle of town now.
That's where you got interested in engineering and engines and all those things.
I was always interested in engines. I always planned to be an engineer. And then the war came along and changed all of it, and I became an aviator. But I had 3 years in engineering school in 1970. Instead of going back to school for my fourth year, I went into the service. And then one of the first things they did was give us another year of schooling.
So you actually got your degree then while you were in the service?
No, yes and no. What happened was that after that, they sent a bunch of us up to MIT to take a master's degree in aeronautical engineering. And I asked for permission to stay longer, which was granted, and I became one of the first doctors of science and aeronautical engineering from MIT.
Not a great plan then. It sort of happened.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that the way things are? If they are meant to be?
I think that some people plan and never carry out the plan. I think I have been more inclined to look for opportunities and take advantage of them and fit them into my scheme of things.
You talk about him. Planning and you know, finding the opportunity to do it. See, and once you're on the right path, my feeling is everything opens up anyway, and all you have to do is recognize it and take advantage of it. See, and when you do, the next thing opens. It's kind of like Elgin's trip around the world.
Yeah.
The things that made it happen were not things you could write about ahead of time. If you were to write about them, people would laugh at you, because they say, oh, that's never going to happen. But it did, and it just became, you have to recognize the next spot you're supposed to be in. And you just do that. If you don't allow yourself to get caught up with, oh, I can't do that, or it's never going to happen, or, you know, so many people defeat themselves.
Well, I think we've
taken a lot of your time. Oh. We really appreciate your seeing us, because he's had a desire to talk to you about this blind flying.
So you gave me an opportunity to talk about me.
He really has wanted to, he'd like to see something done more to make flying safer. You know, they've got problems they have to become overcome, and that's really, he's been working on a couple of projects. He has a project that people, they shake their heads at him, and we've tried to patent it. He has a plan for how to use the interior of a small aircraft so you can instantly convert it to cargo. And so we've kind of put it aside because it hasn't been right. But someday they're going to use it, because that's his experience. He knows what...